What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, I'm Tom Butler.
I'm Brendan Duffy.
And I'm Tom Wheatley.
And you're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us as three lifelong 007 fans go on a journey of discovery.
We're on a mission to discover everything we can about cinema's greatest spy films.
By learning about the people who made them, in front of the camera and behind.
The James Bond A to Z podcast is in no way affiliated with James Bond, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We've researched each episode as extensively as we can, but our information does come from a range of sources. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we can get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us at podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Hello, you are listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast. My name is Tom Butler. As always, I'm joined by Tom Wheatley.
Hello.
And Mr. Brendan Duffy.
Hi.
We are in the letter C as we go on our encyclopedic journey through the world of the James Bond films. This week, it's a mixed bag. We're going to be speaking to about a bunch of different people, a fashion designer, a few actors, an editor, and a character. So it's a real varied show this week. And yeah, I hope you enjoy it. If you haven't listened yet to our Casino Royale specials, they are out there. Worth a listen. They are quite meaty, but they were fun to do. Yeah. Actually, it's a bit of a welcome change of pace this week, I think. Something a bit more chilled and relaxed, let's say.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I definitely had a bit more spare time this week.
So, C is for Castle. Cyril Castle. Now, Cyril Castle is a tailor, quite a renowned tailor, who was, Savile Row. And he dressed Roger Moore for the films Live and Let Die and The Man with the Golden Gun. Worth saying that it was with shirt maker Frank Foster. So he was Roger Moore's tailor, basically, for a very long time, until Roger moved out of the UK into tax exile in the 1970s. So, yeah, who was Cyril Castle? Well, he was a celebrity tailor, and he had many famous clients, including Richard Todd, Terry Thomas, Lee Mortimer. And then later on, his other clients included people like Terence Stamp and Frank Sinatra. Actually, Frank Sinatra, it's believed that he went to Cyril Castle after seeing the film The Man with the Golden Gun, because he liked what he'd done for Roger Moore. So that's an interesting fact. Apparently him and Sammy Davis Jr. tracked him down after seeing that film, which is quite interesting.
Well, it's got a very kind of Frank Sinatra-style character set up in it. It's all that kind of gangster Italian style, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not surprising that he'd like that.
So, yeah, Cyril Castle, he dressed Roger for years. Other films that he dressed him on and shows include Cross Plot, The Man Who Haunted Himself, one of my favourite of Sir Roger's. Gold, and then also his TV shows The Saint and The Persuaders. So from this is from Roger's book, Bond on Bond. Roger said, "When I stepped into the role, I suggested that my longtime tailor, Cyril Castle of Mayfair, with whom I had worked on The Saint and The Persuaded, would give Jim a more contemporary look for the 1970s. Jim, obviously, he means James Bond. Lots of modern colours, sports jackets and trousers became the new norm. The designs were fashionable, yet also elegant and comfortable." I have to confess, I mean, I'm not really like that au fait with fashion and designers and tailoring and all that sort of stuff. I found this stuff really interesting to learn about. But yeah, so before Cyril Castle came along, so obviously we were coming into the Roger Moore films after six Sean Connery films, one George Lazenby. But Sean Connery's Bond had stuck to this style or this template, which they call the conduit cuts suits. Now, the conduit style, and that's named after Conduit Street in Mayfair near Savile Row. It is two button jackets, solid coloured shirts, and then unpatterned sort of plain grenadine and knit ties. And the suits are often by Anthony Sinclair, and his and Sean Connery's shirts are by Turnbull and Asser. So by bringing in a new design, it was bringing in a fresh look for Bond. So he would keep this sort of simple elegance brought in by Sean Connery, but Cyril Castle will help to expand the palette of colours that Bond wore, and also the styles as well. So it expanded it a bit more. And so that first film, Live and Let Die, and then A Man with a Golden Gun, really set the template for Roger's Bond. He then started wearing more double-breasted suits, and he would wear more different colours. So where Sean Connery was wearing always dark blue or earth colours, Roger would wear cooler colours, lighter colours, and sometimes warmer earth tones as well. Interesting to note that Cyril Castle was also a neighbour of Connery's tailor, Anthony Sinclair, on Conduit Street. And he was famed for having sort of a bit more of an eye on the fashion trends than a traditional look. So that's really suited Roger's Bond. So he brought in the flared trousers to Bond. And it was, first of all, it was a more of a subtle sort of look than the bolder sort of flared leg. But that sort of expanded and got wider with The Man with the Golden Gun. Interestingly, Cyril Castle also dressed Yaphet Kotto on Live and Let Die as well. So he wears a lot of tan suits as well, and they're quite distinctive. I will say there's a lot of really good Bond fan sites dedicated to the suits that you can see in the film. Bond Suits, I think, is one that I saw. And then there's another more general films website, Clothes on Film. They have a really good breakdown of all the clothes in the Bond films. But yeah, so Cyril Castle's premises are at number 42 Conduit Street, and there's actually a shop called Wardrobe there at the moment. And he had previously had a place on 10 Sackville Street, but that's basically his extent of his involvement in the Bond films. He helped dress Roger for two films, changed the look of Bond slightly. I don't know if you remember Live and Let Die, but Roger comes in and he's got this real big, like, double-breasted navy jacket on. Really bold look for him. It's sort of, you know, hinting at Bond's naval heritage without being a bit over the top. But yeah, quite interesting to look into how Bond looks and what he wears in the films. It's not something I pay a huge amount of attention to, but
yeah, when you were talking about him doing Roger, I've always known that Roger's style changes massively from the previous films, but never really thought about it. I just assumed it would change with the time, so it's interesting to hear that was an action, that was a plan, they actually wanted to do that.
Just something you accept, isn't it, when you're watching it? It's just like, oh, but it's subconscious, I guess. Like, you know the actor's changed, but you're thinking, oh, what else has changed? But not actually going, oh, it must be the suit. But yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, he worked with two more tailors on his tenure as Bond. We'll look at those in later episodes. But yeah, that's Cyril Castle.
C is for Cavill, Henry Cavill. So Henry Cavill is an English actor who I imagine most of the people listening are aware of.
They've probably heard of him, yeah.
Yeah. He auditioned for the role of 007 in 2005. So before Casino Royale, so you just covered Casino Royale where we mentioned Craig getting the role. But Cavill got down to the final four, and the producers really, you know, were pushing for going for him. but the age was an issue. And so, you know, in the favour of Craig, because he was slightly older and that's what they wanted for this.
And how was he then? How old was he? 22?
He was 22.
Yeah.
Very young.
If you can go online, there is a picture of him in the audition. That's all there is. There's no, you can't hear him, you know, read the dialogue. But yeah, he does look very young as well. It would have been interesting to see a version with such a young Bond in Casino Royale.
Well, the concept works, doesn't it, I suppose. 22 does sound a bit young for the storyline, but he was meant to be wet behind the ears and an early agent. But 22 sounds like you've barely even started your career. You've just...
Yeah.
Henry Cavill strikes me as one of those guys that probably looked about 20 when he was 16.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of those big lads at school. So I think he probably would have been able to pull it off. I mean, it's hard to believe... Yeah. MI6 would recruit someone of that age to be a secret agent. I don't know what the process is, but I imagine they get them out of university, right?
Yeah.
Well, they must every time they cast one of these, a new Bond, they must think the best thing that we could possibly do is get somebody young who looks a little bit older, because then we've got them for at least 20 years. Yeah. Obviously never works like that, but no. if it did, that would be the perfect scenario.
So in the audition, so he recalls, "I probably could have prepared better. I remember the director, Martin Campbell, saying, 'Looking a little chubby there, Henry.' I didn't know how to train or diet, and I'm glad Martin said something because I respond well to truth. It helps me get better." Quite a harsh thing to say, I think, in this day and age now, looking back. I think 2005 seems like a long time ago. But he said it helped him, so, you know. Helped him become who he is now, so I guess that's a good thing. But you probably know him from playing Superman. That's probably the role that people are going to know him from. But he did actually audition, and he was going to play Superman in 2004. So even younger.
Brandon Routh version.
Well, no, it was a McG version called Superman Flyby.
Mm.
But then Bryan Singer came in and recast, Brandon Routh as the lead in Superman Returns. So he lost that role, but then went on to get the role in 2011, where he was announced as Superman in Zack Snyder's Man of Steel, which came out in 2013. Yeah. So he's got form for auditioning for a role, not being successful, and then getting it. So maybe moving forward, that might happen again. He's lost out to Robert Pattinson twice. I found that quite interesting. Cedric Diggory in Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire in 2005.
Interesting. What? That's interesting.
Yeah. And Stephanie Meyer, who's the author of the Twilight series, she wanted Cavill to play Edward Cullen in the Twilight films. She called him the perfect Edward, but...
I'm trying to think what my view on that is, but I think it's just I don't care about either of those characters.
But yeah, he was too old by the time they came around to making the film. So he's never the right age, is he? He's always it's the wrong age. He has played an Ian Fleming character in 2015 in The Man from U.N.C.L.E., where he played Napoleon Solo, which for me is probably my most favourable performance of his, I would say.
He's great in that.
Yeah. He was in Mission Impossible.
I don't think I've seen it yet.
Oh, I recommend it. It's quite good. Yeah. Mission Impossible Fallout. He was in that as well. And then he's been in Enola Holmes as Sherlock Holmes.
Netflix. What he has been good in is The Tudors. He was very good in The Tudors.
Yes. That was probably the thing that most people knew him for, wasn't it, at the time?
His Remington Steele, isn't it? That's his... that was four seasons of playing that character.
Are you comparing him to Brosnan?
Well...
Shots fired.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what triggered his career, I guess, and helped him to get these roles. But more recently, as last year, he has said, if Barbara, so he's speaking about Barbara Broccoli, if Barbara and Mike, that's Michael G. Wilson, were interested in that, I would absolutely jump at the opportunity. So that's his response to being, you know, if he was asked to play Bond. So he still wants to play it, and he's 37 now, so he's probably... just about the right age, really.
He's just the right side of 40, isn't he?
Yeah.
For a 10-year tenure.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But, so not yet, but maybe.
Well, now that his time on Justice League and those films looks like it's coming to an end.
Yeah.
It would free him up. He would be the most famous person to take on Bond, like pre...
I reckon he's probably at about the same level as Roger Moore at the time when he got it.
Yeah, I guess Roger was pretty famous, wasn't he?
Yeah. I mean, the levels of films that he's doing... I mean, obviously Superman's a big one, but I don't think it's a big one, but it's not an amazing film. It's not like he's done amazing work on that film. Which is, I think Roger had done quite a few films before he did Bond as well, hadn't they?
Yeah, but I think fans of those films will say that they like him as Superman. I think the one thing I don't like him as Superman, I'm never convinced by his Clark Kent. I always thought that Brandon Routh did a great Clark Kent, whereas Henry Cavill, I never sort of really buy him as Clark. But then you wonder whether that's because of the 1970s Superman films and the Christopher Reeve Clark Kent that we all sort of grew up with.
Mm. I struggle with Superman because I've never liked Superman in any guise whatsoever. So I've got a bit of a biased view towards Superman, but he's probably one of the most famous options that there have been for a Bond. But maybe that's what they want these days. You don't know. If it doesn't always have to be the same rules, does it? You don't have to have somebody who's not as famous.
No, that's true. The rules have changed, haven't they? And it just really depends on how much he would be asking to be paid, because they always want to pay someone a pittance when they start, right? I think these people often start out on like $250,000 or $500,000.
Well, could the fact that he seems very keen to play it, that maybe might drive the price down a bit? They might be able to get him a bit cheaper. The one plus for me, if he was to get it, is we would have an actor that likes playing the role back again, and I think that'd be good to get.
What would be nice, wouldn't it?
I'm sure they all like it at the start.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I think the problem is with it, a lot of them can't turn it down, because it'd be the biggest mistake. You know, if you turn down Bond and then 2 years later you go, got offered Bond, regretting it now. But so once you get offered it, you kind of feel compelled to take it, don't you? But I think Cavill would be like a bit more like a Roger or a Brosnan. I think he'd like being associated with that role more than people like Sean Connery and Craig.
Yeah. So there we go. Watch this space. Henry Cavill.
C is for Chang. Just Chang. That's he hasn't got two names, has he? If you will remember, do you both know who Chang is?
No, go on. No.
From the Bond series. So he's I'm glad I got this one actually, because he's one of the henchmen in Bond that I always think of as being one of the worst henchmen that's in the whole of the Bond series. He's in Moonraker. He's Drax's right-hand man in Moonraker, and he's played by Toshiro Suga.
Right.
But I'm glad I got this one, because I've always just classed him as an awful henchman. He just doesn't seem in any way to be menacing, dangerous, imposing. He doesn't really do anything in it. But after reading up on him, he's a slightly more interesting actor and character, and why he got that role. So Toshiro Suga was born in 1950... and he's really famous for being... He's an Aikido instructor. And he holds the rank of 7th Dan. Aikikai. I'm not going to be able to get any of these right. I couldn't find any phonetic explanations of these.
Right.
But he's essentially not an actor. He's always been an Aikido expert. He started learning Aikido when he was 17. And he was trained by a man called Marihi Ushiba, who was the man who founded Aikido back in the early 20th century.
Interesting.
So he's got pretty good at this martial art. And I had to look at what Aikido was, because I'd assumed it was like Kendo, because you generally see Chang fighting with Kendo sticks and stuff in Moonraker. But it's more like a hand-to-hand martial arts. And it is the goal of it is to create an art that practitioners could use to defend themselves whilst also protecting their attackers from injury. So it's like this holistic thing that you're not only protecting yourself, you're trying not to hurt the attacker at the same time. So interesting angle on it. And it's called the translation is the Way of the Harmonious Spirit. So straight away, that's quite interesting. Never, didn't, I didn't thought about that sort of thing when I saw him acting in the film, because you don't really see him do a lot of impressive fighting. He taught military forces in Canada for a while, and he had a brief career in cinema. And the reason he got a career in cinema was because of Michael G. Wilson, who was also taught by Ushiba, the guy who founded Aikido. So Toshiro Suga, he lived in France, and because Moonrakers had largely set in France, Michael G. Wilson said, when he was speaking to his teacher, "Is there anyone you know in France who can help us out on this film?" And they said, "Oh yeah, I've got just the guy." He's and put him in touch, and then they went and met together, and he screen tested for the role of Chang, and yeah, he got the role. So he's done the other stuff. He's done French films that came after Moonraker, you would ever have heard of, or there's a lot of information on even. He still lives in Paris. He works for the FFAB, which is a sporting organisation, still training people. So he's basically just an Aikido instructor nowadays. But an interesting thing, there's quite an interesting interview that he did fairly recently in the last few years, talking about his career as an instructor, but also as a Moonraker. And he said at the beginning of filming, when he started doing the movie, he was placed fourth in the credits after Roger Moore, Lois Childs and Michael Lonsdale. Then he dropped down to sixth, and then he dropped down to ninth because all the agents of the other actors were saying, "These guys need to get a better place in the rankings. Can you move them up?" So he kept getting put down because he didn't have an agent. Even Emily Bolton went past him, because she had more scenes of dialogue than him, because he obviously didn't speak that much. So they all had these arguments for going higher and higher. So because he had no agent, he couldn't defend himself. So he just had to go, "Yes, it's fine, whatever." But he says it's fine because he doesn't really mind. He wasn't an actor. He didn't really care about that. And he just liked being in a Bond film, really. That was what was important to him. So he just said that was an interesting thing. And the other thing he said about not having an agent is that when he went to the premiere in London, all of the cast had their own agents. So they all just got flown over, like first class and staying in hotels. And he said he had to fund the whole trip himself. He had to pay for the transport, accommodation to attend, the taxi to the theatre. So yeah, didn't really jump into the world of movie making very hard. He said that he quickly left movie making because it was very difficult to break through. And Michael G. Wilson has said to him that you've got to go to the United States or you've got to go back to Japan, because in France there's no roles for Asian people. And he said, "Well, I want to stay in France, so that's the end of my movie making career." So that's it, really. But I see that character as in a whole new light now. And I've warmed to him a bit more than when I originally thought he's the worst henchman in Bond.
The more you know.
Yeah.
So, C is for Matt Chessay. Who is Matt Chessay, I hear you ask?
Yeah, who is Matt Chessay? I thought it was Matt Cheese.
I thought it was Matt Cheese until I realised I'd made a typo. Apologies, Matt Chessay.
I thought he sounds more interesting as Matt Cheese.
Born in October 27th, 1965, Matt Chessay is an American film editor, producer and director. Made a lot of independent films. He's actually Oscar nominated, though, in 2004 for Best Film Editing on the film Finding Neverland, directed by Mark Forster. So he is known, Matt Chessay is known for mainly making films with Mark Forster. So the two of them sort of go together. Yeah, so Mark Forster is a German director, and Matt Chessay and Mark Forster, they worked together on Quantum of Solace. That's the James Bond connection. But who is he? His credits include Monsters Ball, Finding Neverland, Stranger Than Fiction, Warrior, Machine Gun Preacher, World War Z, Money Monster, Christopher Robin, and 2021's most critically reviled film, Music. That's the one directed by Sia about autism, which has been nominated for tons of Razzies. So, yeah, there you go. But I'm sure his editing is fine on the film. That's not a reflection on him. So Chessay was born and raised in the San Francisco Bay Area. He's got a degree in English literature. And after college, he moved to LA to assist a guy called Peter Kagan, who was a director of commercials at a commercial company. He then worked as an assistant to Angus Wall, who is an editor at another commercial editorial place. And then he worked under, and then he became an editor under a couple of guys called David Lee and Lauren Zuckerman. So the connection with Mark Forster began in 2000 with a film called Everything Put Together. And it was Chesse's friend, Adam Forgash, who actually wrote the film, who introduced him to the director. This is Chesse talking. Adam knew what my sensibilities were. We did our Quentin Tarantino film school thing and watched a lot of movies. He vouched for my head and heart and hoped my skills would go along. And they did. And they, got along famously. So Forster then brought Chesse and the crew on that film onto Monsters Ball, which is a critically acclaimed film that won the Oscar for Halle Berry, who would later become Jinx in Die Another Day. So another James Bond connection there. So then after Monsters Ball, Mark Forster then came on board to make Quantum of Solace, and he brought Matt Chesse on. And as we discussed, I don't know if you remember this, but when we talked about I can't remember his name now, when they brought on editors for Tomorrow Never Dies, they brought on two because it made a speedier process. The name will come to me in a minute, but basically they had Matt Chesse and Richard Pearson just literally for the sake of the speed of these things. As you remember, they normally shoot these films at the beginning of the year and have them out in November. That used to be the cadence that they worked for. Obviously not anymore. They make them and then wait 3 years to put them out. That's a joke, obviously. So this is an interview that Matt Chesse did with a website called Movie Maker, talking about his partnership with Mark Forster. He said, "We have definitely evolved a system of working together. Our roles have become refined and our tastes have become aligned. I'm actually working with another editor, Richard Pearson, because of the time schedule on Quantum of Solace, and it's the first time I've collaborated with another editor, with Mark." So talking about working with Richard Pearson, he said, "Working with another editor has pointed out to me how comfortable it had gotten with Mark. I think because of the amount of time we've worked together, I could drive everything in the direction Mark likes, and he can sign off things very quickly, and there isn't a whole lot of talking. It just flows, sort of like that secret language of twins." So you can see they're a very collaborative working together, a very close relationship, Matt and Mark Forster. So when you're working on projects like this, you're aware that it will be seen, and it is a juggernaut of expectations to step into that's both exhilarating and intimidating. It's like walking in somebody else's shoes. So that's like him, you know, obviously aware of the weight of expectation with making a James Bond film. Obviously, Quantum of Solace is a film that has many problems associated with it. And have you guys watched it recently?
No.
Yes.
Did one of you say yes?
Yes. Yep.
What did you think?
Well, in terms of the editing...
Well, just in general.
Well, I don't like Quantum of Solace at all. I think it's a very difficult film to watch, and I think it lacks the style of Bond that I'd normally expect. It just doesn't. It doesn't feel right when I'm watching it. It just seems to be missing something. But I do remember the editing in it, actually, from especially that first scene. It's very quick, which I did find a bit jarring in that first section.
Yeah, I would say some of the fight stuff and the action stuff is quite. Some of it's a bit confusing, I think, when you watch it. Yeah. Now, I don't know whether that's down to the director not getting enough coverage or whether it's down to the editor, but...
That film, it's difficult to tell with that film, isn't it? It could be anything causing it.
Yeah, the film obviously famously was beset with scripting issues because of the writer's strike, and, you know, Daniel Craig was having to write scenes on the fly with it, and you don't know whether Mark Forster was that au fait with making action films or what, but yeah, it's a bit of a mess, and there's no denying that at all. I find it quite hard to follow as well in terms of what the plot is. It's a great concept, though, you know, the follow-up, the revenge film to Casino Royale. It's just a shame that it doesn't work. If I was going to remake any Bond film, I think it would be this one. It would be great to let them have another go at it. But
they should go back and do that with all the bad Bond films.
Yeah.
There's too many to do.
Oh, Brendan. Who's the cynic now?
At least we keep all the Brosnans, eh, Brendan?
Yep.
Don't touch them. Put more scenes in.
Get him to remake the old ones.
Yeah. So listen to this. This is a quote from Mark Forster. And we'll do Mark Forster in more detail when we get to F. And we'll also do more on Quantum of Solace when we get to Q. But this is a quote from Mark Forster. He was talking to Time Out. He said, "I have way too little time to edit. We wrapped the movie just a few weeks ago, and I'm basically editing right now for another week or so. Then I show it to Michael and Barbara, a little preview screening, and then I have another week to cut. So I have like 5 or 6 weeks to edit the whole movie. Normally I've had 14 weeks for any of my films so far. 6 weeks for this film is crazy. So even at this point, this is before the film is released, and he's talking the film up to the press, you know, as a preview feature. And he's already saying, I haven't got enough time. You know, you've got to wonder what could have been done if they had more time to refine it in the edit. You don't know. So just following on from that, he said, this is the same interview before the film has come out. I wish we would have more time to craft the film properly. For instance, with The Dark Knight, Christopher Nolan had a year to cut his movie to work on the visual effects to reflect, I don't have that time, and so compromises have to be made. So you could tell then he knew that point that he was hamstrung with this film. It was not going to work out the way he wanted it to, which is a real shame when you've got all these really great craftspeople like him and Matt Chessay and...
Yeah, well, I suppose when you work on a Bond film, you've got to cover your back, haven't you? Your career on the line with Bond, really. If it comes out and everyone goes, that was awful, that's an awful Bond film. Probably, he's probably sat there worrying every day going, I've got to say something, otherwise... can look bad on me.
Yeah, people just think you're a bad filmmaker. But
I wonder if there is a good cut in there. I wonder if that's available. If you know, if he was given a couple more weeks.
Yeah.
If it was written off before, you know,
you're going to start a petition.
Thing is, it's got some really nice visuals in it, and it's got some really cool, interestingly edited scenes. Like, I don't know if you remember, but there's the bit at the start when they've brought Mr. White to the safe house, and they're in like this Italian town, and they've got that horse racing thing going on outside, and then Bond is chasing after that rogue agent, and it sort of intercuts between the horse race and him and the chase, and it's all quite interesting. And then they do a similar thing later on at the opera, you know, when they're communicating the quantum people are communicating their plan over their headpieces, and it cuts between the opera and the fight scene between Bond, and it is really nicely done in those scenes. And visually it's a really interesting stuff. There's a lot of stuff going on with water and the earth and fire, so I think there's a great film in there wanting to get out, but it's just hamstrung by something. And it could be the plotting, because I think it's hard to follow. It's really hard to follow what's going on. You're constantly introducing new ideas, and
it could have been that it was an attempt to fix the plotting through editing, but it was just, I mean, from what we've heard of the scripting and everything on that film, it's quite likely that was an almost uneditable storyline to do anyway. So make it more action, you make it quicker, but it just doesn't quite work.
I think if they'd had more time, they might have been able to do pickups and add extra lines in, or, you know, various bits like that to kind of tinker with the plotting. But fortunately, the time constraints they were working to just didn't work for it. Anyway, just wrapping up with Matt Chessay, he lives in LA now. He's got 2 children. Music was his most recent film, but he's a busy editor. He's very much still working today. So, yeah, that's him.
C is for Chin, Cai Chin. So Cai Chin was born in China on the 1st of September, 1933. She is an actor, singer, theatre director, and a teacher of drama. So she has been in 2 Bond films. The first occurrence was as Ling in the pre-title sequence in You Only Live Twice, where Bond is in bed with Ling, and then they fake Bond's death, don't they? He goes up in the bed. She presses a button. They come in and shoot him. So that's it's brief. It's a brief cameo, but that's the role she plays in that. And then in 2006. She came back as another character, Madame Wu, and she is... I mean, we don't really know much about the character herself. It's assumed she's a professional card player.
Casino Royale you're talking about, right?
Yeah, Casino Royale, 2006. She's first seen on Le Chiffre's boat playing cards, and then again, she takes part in the main event of the film, the big poker game. So she's one of the 10 card players. I think she sits next to Bond, doesn't she?
I think you're right, yeah.
So yeah, that's her two forays into Bond. Her brother was actually in You Only Live Twice, Michael Chow. He was a Spectre Agent 4 who played. So I imagine he will get his own section.
It may be. I mean, we try and hit most of the big hitters, but some do fall through the cracks.
So she, her career, I mean, she's still active now. And so she's made a lot of films. She's done a lot in her long career. So I'm just going to touch on some of the highlights I found quite interesting. She came to London when she was 19. She moved from Shanghai, and it was her ambition to study drama. Her father was an operatic singer, so she'd already sort of got a taste for performance. She said, "I was supposed to follow my elder sister to America to finish my education, but I received the RADA prospectus, and that sealed my fate." So that sort of took her off course on what she was meant to do, and she became the first Chinese student to ever attend RADA.
Oh, wow.
So she studied there, she graduated. And in 1960, she actually had a musical hit. Lionel Bart wrote a song called The Ding Dong Song. Have either of you heard of this?
No.
No, it sounds made up. I'm not making this up. This is real. She said, Lionel asked me if I wanted to make a record. Being young, foolish and fearless, I said yes. Before I knew it, I was in the Decca studio with a large orchestra behind me. Lionel also asked me to sing very high, which I did, although I'd never taken a singing lesson before. Millions were sold, and so this was a huge hit in Africa and Asia, but most were pirated, so I didn't get any money. So that's a shame. She's had a huge hit. She's not received any royalties from that. But I did listen to it, and I won't listen to it again.
It's a novelty record, is it?
It is very high. She does sing very high. So Psy was one of the very few faces that were Chinese on British TV throughout the 60s. Obviously, it was a different time then, and you would mostly see white faces, but she starred in Emergency Ward 10, Dixon of Dock Green, which I've heard of. I think it's about police.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And That Was the Week That Was. Always confuses me reading that out. That Was the Week That Was. She became so famous during the 60s, actually, that London Zoo named a leopard after her.
Wow.
So
that's pretty
so
good.
She was, you know, a pretty big deal in Britain in the 60s. So she does talk about her Bond time, because we're coming up to the late 60s. That's when she did You Only Live Twice. But she finds it quite dull talking about it. I guess she wasn't in it that much. So, yeah. You know, it's not a
and
huge
part. And she's done a load of other stuff as well.
Exactly. So the scene actually took 3 days, that opening scene of You Only Live Twice. She says, "People nowadays are so impressed I was a Bond girl, so I might as well go along with it. People ask me what it was like being in bed with Sean Connery. I say, fine." So she's not even enamoured with Sean Connery. So in that opening scene, if you recall, Bond asks Ling, "Why do Chinese girls taste so different from the others?" Yeah. So this is going to make... This made me itch. It's going to make me itch reading it out, so I apologise. But this is just... I'm just lifting this from... This is dialogue from the film. Ling replies, "You think we better, huh?" Bond says, "No, just different. Like Peking duck is different from Russian caviar. But I love them both." And Ling replies, "Darling, I give you very best duck." So she's recently asked about that scene now, and she says, "It wouldn't pass muster now, thank God. Then Asian women were especially stereotyped." So, you know, yeah, she is more than, you know, just as uncomfortable as I hope everyone else is at that scene. It's just, but she acknowledges that things have moved on, which is good. She also, in the 60s, she also starred in 5 films as Fu Manchu's daughter, which is also problematic.
Yeah.
Again, because Christopher Lee played the lead role. Mm. So, she's a really successful career. I'm going to sort of skip forward a bit, but she's a huge part of Chinese and UK relations as well. And she's got an autobiography out, which is a bestseller. It's been printed in 10 languages. So if you did want to learn, go, you know, do a really deep dive, there's that out there to do so. But in 1993, she relocated to Hollywood, and she lives in LA to this day. And she took on a role of Auntie Lindo in the Joy Luck Club. Have either of you seen this?
I'm aware of it.
Yeah, it was critically acclaimed, especially her performance, and the film was touted to at least be nominated for awards, the Academy Awards. And, you know, reviewers are singing Sy's praises. The New York Times said, despite its huge cast, the film is virtually stolen by Sy Chin. It didn't get nominated for any awards. Who knows why that was, but it's, you know, a lot of people were up in arms at the time when that happened. So that's one to look out for, I guess. One that slipped under the radar. So she was 62 when she moved to Hollywood, and she sees that as like a third wave of her career. She's been given this opportunity to be in many things. So she's been in Grey's Anatomy, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Memoirs of a Geisha, and I've technically been in a film with her.
Go on.
Technically.
Go on.
I was a supporting artist on Now You See Me Too, and she stars in that film. So technically, we've been in the same film.
Wow. That's magic.
In 2019, I think it was released last year, actually, she's in a film called Lucky Grandma, which is set in New York, in Chinatown. And it's about a chain-smoking Chinese grandma who, she goes to the casino and she has a big win, but it's gang money. And then she gets all caught up in sort of gang turf wars. Watch the trailer. Looks very good. It's got positive reviews.
That sounds good.
I think I might check that out, actually. And again, everyone's praising Sy Chin's performance as being fantastic. It's 95% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, so maybe one to check out. And then just to round up, so there's an interview with The Guardian, which is available, and they just asked her about sort of the last year, you know, lockdown and everything. So she said, China is under super control. Trump's territory seems to be falling off in bits. The pandemic is depressing enough. Do we need to go there? I'm very happy that I'm going to be pissing off soon. So...
I like the sound of this lady.
Yeah, she's... I mean, there are interviews on YouTube and she just says it like it is. She does not hold back. She's, yeah. And then they asked her what she'd been doing during lockdown. So she said, lots of little old ladies potter in their gardens. For me, it's my library. It has every subject about China I can collect and, of course, about theatre. So she's massively passionate about theatre, of which she's directed theatre shows, and she's she continues to teach drama as well. She's also spent time watching YouTube clips of babies and dogs and cats. She said, they cheer me up because they are the purest things I can find at the moment. So, yeah, that's Sy Chin. And, yeah, quite an interesting lady.
Certainly sounds like you've had fun researching her.
Yeah, I did.
She not say anything about Casino Royale?
Not really. I tried to figure out, you know, if it was an... it seemed like it's a bit of a nod.
Right.
The casting of, you know, having a, and especially having her next to Bond, as a kind of, a lot of people say, oh, is she his guardian angel? Yeah. That's not confirmed, but it's a nice idea, you know. But no, there's not a lot there. She doesn't have a line, does she either? Doesn't have a speaking role.
No. I always wonder whether she in on Bond's plot. In You Only Live Twice or not?
Well, apparently so.
She is.
She's down as an ally.
Right. Okay.
So yeah, she's
because they're kissing, she traps him in the bed, and then
yeah,
because he's on the bed on his own, isn't he?
He's on the bed. She jumps out of the bed, presses the button, the bed goes up. And then when I first saw it, I thought, oh, she's because it's classic. Bond's always getting done over, isn't he? But you know. By a double agent or something. So yeah, but according to sources across the board, she is an MI6 ally.
There you go. Mm.
So yeah,
interesting. C is for Chin, Anthony Chin. So Anthony Chin, he's quite he's been in a lot of Bond films. If you but you probably don't know. Well, you will know one of the characters he plays. The other ones are kind of extra roles. but he's an actor who is born in 1930. He died in 2000. And he's classed as a supporting actor who's appeared in over 50 films and television series throughout his career. And it's a very long career as well. His parents were, one was Chinese and the other was Brazilian. So he had quite an interesting heritage. And he moved to London in 1961, where he spent a lot of time appearing in a lot of shows that we talk about a lot in this podcast. So you've got The Avengers, Danger Man, The Protectors, Steptoe and Son, Gerry Anderson's UFO, all those kind of stalwart British series that a lot of actors that have appeared in Bond have also appeared in as
it's
well.
It's like the Bill and Holby City of the 70s, isn't it? 60s and 70s.
Yeah, it's kind of a rites of passage, isn't it? You eventually get to Bond, but you move through the ranks of these various other ones as well. And sometimes some of the roles he's had in those series have been considerably larger than the ones that he's had in Bond. But then eventually he did come to playing in Bond. And the first role is he's in Doctor No. You'll know him if you see a picture of him, but only just because you remember his face. I don't think he talks in it. So in Doctor No, he plays a chief technician. In Goldfinger, he plays a servant at the stud farm. He's actually the servant that brings Goldfinger and Bond the mint julep.
Nice.
Yeah,
which I hadn't spotted at all before. He's in You Only Live Twice as control room technician, but all of those roles, they're all kind of uncredited roles, but he actually got a proper role quite a lot later on, actually, considering these were all in like the first Bond films. A View to a Kill, he turns up as the Taiwanese, let me just get this right, it's different titles. I think it's like Taiwanese Tycoon.
Right.
But it's like a proper role, and you'll know who he is when I tell you. It's where they're in the blimp, and they're all sat around the table. And he's the guy who doesn't want to take part in the plan.
Right.
And he obviously walks out, and he says, "Well, that's fine. You leave, and we'll carry on the meeting." And they drops through the hole in the floor, and they drop him over San Francisco Bay. So proper role for him that, and I think that's quite an important role in that film. Really, it's quite an iconic part of that film. He's in other things as well that you will have known of, or some that you will have known of. He was in John Huston's The Kremlin Letter. I don't know what that is. He was also in The Pink Panther Strikes Again and Revenge of the Pink Panther. And also he played a character called Mohan in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I didn't know who that was when I first looked at it. And in fact, it took me a while to work out who he was. But I think he works in a bar at the start. If you look him up online, Mohan, Raiders of the Last Ark, you'll know who the character is. But and then he's also in The Fifth Element as a technician, which I did not remember him being in. He's done a lot of other work as well. He's appeared in theatre and TV adverts. The only example I could find was McEwan's beer, so that's
wow,
interesting one. But really, other than that, it's quite cool that he's been in four Bond films.
Yeah,
and over two decades. Yeah, there's not a lot really on the man.
I've just looked him up on Indiana Jones. So he's in the Nepalese bar in Raiders where Marion is having the drinking competition.
Yes.
With the guy. Yeah. One of my favourite scenes, that is.
It's good that. I was surprised at that one because all the other scenes, if you look at this guy up and you see the films he's been in, you go, oh yeah, of course. And your face is so recognisable. But in that scene, he's not playing... I can't remember where it's set, but is it Nepal?
Nepal, yeah.
Yeah, but the way he's dressed and everything, you don't immediately think it's the same character because he's so used to playing these men in suits that or like weird outfits because he's some sort of henchman. So yeah, it's an interesting role for him. But anyway, that's that is Anthony Chin.
A minor Hall of Famer, I think.
Yeah.
Well, that's it for another episode of the James Bond A to Z podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Where can people find us if they want to track us down on social media?
On all the big ones, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at James Bond A to Z.
And on email at podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
As always, if you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a good rating and a review. It all helps to... help us grow the podcast. Tell your friends, tell your enemies. This has been a fun episode. We'll be back next week with Another mixed bunch of topics, including a film studio, a film distributor, a writer, an editor, some Bond henchmen, and a stunt driver. So that's going to be an interesting one to talk about. But thank you for listening. James Bond will return.
Thanks a lot.
Ciao.
The James Bond A to Z podcast features Tom Butler, Brendan Duffy, and Tom Wheatley. The podcast was produced by Tom Wheatley, with music by Tom Ingemels, and artwork supplied by Helen Dolly.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.